This is the Decentered Media Podcast with me, Rob Watson. Conversations about foundational and decentralized media. For more information, visit decentered.co.uk or follow on social media at Decentered Media. Hello, it's, what day is it? It's Wednesday the 17th. Wednesday the 17th of...
All day.
...of June, and I'm joined by... John Costa. How are you, John?
I'm very well. When was the last time we did a recording, my friend?
Well, it was before you went to Nigeria. So
we should talk about that.
We should talk about that. So what? Yeah, tell us what you got up to. So you've recently come back. It was a couple of weeks ago that you got back now, and time just disappears really quickly. But what was your trip about, and have you recovered?
To take the second part first, no, I've not recovered. It takes me longer these days. It takes me about 3 or 4 weeks just to get back into the rhythm of being in the UK and food and sleep and catching up on paperwork and stuff, which is a really interesting way of thinking about the trip, really, because now it's not about how long you're away for, it's what impacts are you going to have on the trip and what impacts it going to have on you when you return. So I was there for 4 weeks, and it was quite an intense trip, actually. Again, involved quite a lot of travelling, because I think when I go every 3 months, it's more about they want me to make lots of content while I'm there, you know. So we have situations where I'll record 3 30-minute episodes of a show back to back, and I have to go and change a shirt in between, which is quite interesting, and 3 separate subjects you talk about. But then there's travel on the road and staying in accommodation for big events that you go to, because of the impact of having a white face, for example, involved in a particular event really helps to unlock the door, because it internationalizes it from their perspective. So it's a real kind of mix of emotions and feelings that you have throughout those 30 days, particularly when it comes to things like food, and I really enjoy their food, and they're quite shocked. And it's taken me 3 visits to realise that when they say to me, "Well, Mr. John, you must really like to have something different, reminds you of home, let's go for Domino's pizza or something like that," they want a Domino's pizza, not because you have shown an inclination to not eat Jollof rice anymore. So it's really interesting.
Let's just back up a little bit and explain what the purpose of the visit and the relationship is with the organisation that you support.
Yeah, so I've been a lead consultant since April last year with a new television station called S24, and I've helped them to establish a media house that's got, you know, 3 or 4 studios, lots of interview spaces, set up lots of programs, a new business magazine which is in development, a documentary unit, a mobile journalism unit. So using all of my experience of Citizen's Eye and content that I've created here, even teaching at De Montfort University with yourself, looking at putting into place new ideas and concepts that we know can work, which can help with their skill set develop these kind of opportunities. So it was my third trip. I went in August last year for 2 weeks, and I went in November for 3 weeks. So it was good to go back and build on 6 members of staff in August, 12 in November, 35 now, you know. So standing up and doing a staff meeting for 35 members of staff, of which I only know 12, is quite interesting. And I came away having set up like 8 WhatsApp groups, because that's the best way for me to manage it from the UK going on. But I really understand the face-to-face value of meeting people, which I have a lot of meetings in the evening. I end up working sort of, you know, 7 days a week for the 4 weeks that I'm there. And they always say to me, you know, do you want some time off? And he said, well, what would I do with time off? You know, I'm here as a visitor. I need to immerse myself in the culture, go and visit museums, go and visit coffee shops, meet lots of different people. Because then it's easier when you're talking to people through WhatsApp or having Zoom calls with them, because you've met them. And I said to the newsroom, which surprised some of them, particularly those that probably met me for the first time, and I was, you know, was being a little bit arrogant or possibly cheeky, was the fact that, well, I've got better networks in Nigeria than you have, and you're Nigerian, because I've gone out of my way to get that total sector knowledge. You're just doing a job. I'm, you know, immersing myself and trying to understand why the media ecosystem is broken and needs to change in Nigeria. You know, what's the impact of politics or brown envelope journalism and stuff? What impact could AI I have on your role? Could it help you more? You need to get out and do mobile journalism. So rather than saying it, well, let's set up a Mojo unit and you get out and do it. And you can see, you know, in the 2 weeks that I've been back, the impact on the individual staff members going out and creating journalism, even if it's out on the street in that Mojo style, using a smartphone, has kind of really changed the content that they're making, because they're then not sitting behind a desk trying to make a Nigerian story out of something that Donald Trump said. They're then thinking about, well, what's the impact of a Nigerian when it comes to the economy changing because Donald Trump's decided not to invest money? You know, so it's much more about putting them at the centre of it.
So why do they want you to help with that? What is it that you bring? Sorry, it sounds like a really naff interview question, doesn't it? But it's like, what's the ethos that you've been able to contribute that they've returned to?
People say to me, how can you go to another country and talk to them about their culture and their lifestyle and their news and feel that you can contribute? And I say that it's because I've done Citizens On here in Leicester, and that was never about the news. It was never about being a community reporter or a citizens journalist. It was never about user-generated content. It was about storytelling and people and individuals and the impact of people. We know what happens. You know, we have a very clickbait-driven mainstream media now. So, you know, Jack and Jill went up the hill. Okay, that's the headline. So then when you go into the article, there's nothing about them getting to the top of the hill or then what the outcome was, which is them falling down and breaking their crown, you know. So it's when you use those kind of analogies that people suddenly realise that it's going back to the future, you know, and going back to the future is going back to conversations with people, the impact of people on the street. You know, I'm giving members of staff money out of my own pocket to go out and buy food on the street to interview people, the food vendors, about the impact on prices of food. So it's not telling them what to go and make. Yeah, it's saying to them, if that's what you want to make, the reason you're not making it is because you don't want to walk up to a food vendor without taking their time. So by buying some food, you're buying their time to talk to you. They're happy to you to talk. So we have all these kind of conversations all the time about, what was Citizens Eye about? It was volunteer-led. It was about telling stories. It was about the same community news cafe every Tuesday, 9:30 till 10 for 7 years. It's saying to them, you've got to go out. You've got to talk to people. You've got to develop these stories. This is how AI could help you as an assistant, for example, to help you structure it. Not tell you what to do. You know what to do because you're a reporter. You're a journalist. And so I'm constantly getting them to think about, I don't have the answer. What I'm saying to you is, I've seen what's worked and what's not worked. Let's go and do it together. Let's organise a storytelling lab and bring some students in. Then we pay for the taxi to get them there, because transport's a real big thing with the cost of fuel at the moment. But then the students, what they get out of it, four of them are still involved in two programmes about health and food that we're developing. But you've got to do that in order to put that investment in to make it work, and then be able to help and support and monitor. And it's wonderful what you see people create, because they're suddenly creating something they thought they never could do, because it always seemed as if like it was on the other side of the hill. And I was like, well, you're already on the other side of the hill physically. You just mentally need to get yourself there, that you're worthy to tell that story. And why shouldn't you? Because you're a Nigerian. And I think that's really what it's about.
If I summarise it in my terms, it's about building a news network through relationships, not through processes. I mean, you know, processes are important, but you put in the relationships with people and the trust and the engagement between people first, and then because otherwise you can just leave everything to a kind of automated management process. Somebody sends out a track. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, you look at different social media sites, platforms, a lot of people don't use X and do use Blue Sky, but I find when I go onto Blue Sky, it's just press releases from organisations, and they're just using it as a mechanical process, and what they're not doing is engaging with other people and building up any kind of sense of interaction. And it strikes me that a lot of our media has become heavily automated around process, and it ignores that direct content between people.
And it's not about me or with me, or even about things I'm interested in. It's like, this is what's important, take it or leave it. This is what we think the news is. And then when you go out and speak to every single person that you know who then doesn't watch the TV, read a newspaper or listen to the radio and gets their news from social media, for example, what is it on social media that news is doing that the other mainstream media isn't doing? Well, it's things that I'm interested in. So you can't put on the 6 o'clock news. You can find out about a lot of things, but there's not a lot of time, so there's not a lot of depth. So there, you've still got to go off and find it on social media. So people have just cut that out and gone straight to social media to get their news. So what we're trying to say to the people is that you are no different from people. You know, you, just because you're a reporter or a journalist, it doesn't mean that you wouldn't be interested in this content. So how do you put yourself in the audience's mindset that actually... We picked a story, for example, that was about they'd written about a Brazilian bank and the like changes in the interest rates. And I'm like, why is this on our website? And it's like, well, you know, it's an interesting story. It's about somewhere else, blah, blah. I said, but where's the connection to Nigeria? So what happens is then you're generating content because it's part of your 4 pieces a week you have to generate. But what you're not doing is going that extra step, which is turning around and saying, and the last time this similar kind of bank in Nigeria changed the interest rates, this was the impact on the person on the street, whether it's food or, you know, it's cost of living, transport, all these kind of things that your average Nigerian, 220 million of them, worry about. And it's just getting them to understand it's not about generating content. It's about generating the right kind of content that people want to engage with because it's informative. If we just have a whole website full of Jack and Jill went up the hill in America and then Jill and Jack fell down the hill in India, no one's going to make those correlations. You have to be the person that builds that bridge between what happened, why it happened, what's the impact on me, will it impact me, is there anything that I can do about it, and is there anyone with a solution? So then we're into solutions journalism and stuff like that. And I think once you take the time, as we did with our communication arts students or media production students, it wasn't that they were disinterested, it's they'd never been spoken to in that way before. And as soon as you then engage them in that way, they're like, oh, it can't be that easy. You go, well, it is that easy. It's just no one's ever presented to you in that way before. So I think that for me, that's what always drives me. Everything that I do when I'm there, it's always like, oh, that felt like a comm arts session. That felt like a media production, social media practice lesson. That felt like Citizen's Eye, you know.
But in does it go somewhere? Does this follow on? Are people receptive to
this? Yeah, because I think what it is, it's for the first time. It's like saying to someone, it's like inventing fire. You know, people just go, it's amazing. You know, it's magical.
Oh,
you know,
look at the flames.
Oh, you're like Elon Musk. And I was like, well, no, actually, I'm just John Costa from...
But then it's taken to the next stage and saying, well, actually, I can now cook some food and I can actually have a, you know, we can feed our family and we can, you know, or our tribe or whatever it is.
And it's when they do it and then someone gives them some kind of feedback, which is, oh, that was really interesting, I really understood that subject for the first time. And they're like, oh, Mr. John, I tried this and this really worked. And go, yeah, but you did it. Yeah, but you told us to do this. And I said, well, I showed you what to do. I didn't tell you what to do. I said to you, why don't you, I suggested that you could try this. I said, and what you've realised is that you know more than you realise. And I think sometimes it's like people are waiting for permission to tell the story they really want to tell. And then when they do it, they kind of credit you, and it's nothing to do with me. I was very fortunate to be the person in the room that opened that door for them.
Why are we still? I mean, we've been doing this a long time. You know, we're not spring chickens when it comes to this. It's why is it that we're still in this kind of frame of, you know, that kind of permission culture of people who don't make that first. Feel as if they can't take control of their own storytelling. Or, you know, what is it? You know, is it? It's not difficult. I mean, people can share. They've got phones. They can share, overshare maybe stuff on social media and different platforms and stuff. So it's not difficult. But when it comes to kind of, there's a hierarchy of this is proper media, this is professional media, and then the rest of it is like, you know, well, you know, that's social media, and then there's, you know, community media doesn't even get a look in. And it's like, what is it that's stopping people from accepting that they have the power to do things and tell their own stories?
So let's go back, let's rewind the clock back to, you know, for a couple of hundred years people read newspapers. You know, that was the only way to get your news. And then in my grandparents' lifetime, radio came along. Yeah. And then during my parents' lifetime, television was invented. So really, we're only one or two, possibly three generations of having any kind of mass communication and media at all that tells you, as a member of the public, a nobody, as far as the system's concerned, the 1%, what's going on. So since 2010, I mean, we did Citizen's Eye in 2008, so that's still only not even 20 years yet. You know, we're still 17, 18 years away from 2008 to 2028. You're looking at it from the point of view that in the last 20 years, for those that were early adopters, probably the last 15, 16 years for your average person who can remember Vine and Flickr and, you know, Instagram never existed at all when we did Citizen's Eye, 2008, 2014, that within that very short period of time, we completely look at the fact that the mainstream media is serious. And media on digital platforms, social media, digital platforms, is not real. You know, those people use it, serious people use it, but we still don't value it. So it's like, if you only get your news through digital media, it's almost like you're not serious if you don't watch the BBC or read The Guardian or kind of engage these kind of things. But then if you look on something like TikTok, where the news is coming through, you know, LBC, and all this, you might not necessarily agree with these people, but, you know, they're having debates about it that we're not getting on the mainstream media or in a newspaper. So I remember when we first started Citizen's Eye in 2008 was at that time where, you know, calling someone a citizen's journalist was derogatory. It was a derogatory term used by the mainstream media as a way of you thinking, well, how could you possibly be a journalist because you're not qualified? Okay. So then they invented user-generated content. Now, user-generated content had always existed on mainstream television because it was points of view. You wrote in, you know, or you wrote into the editor of a newspaper, and so that was user-generated content. But by allowing the mainstream media to generate the term user-generated content, it allowed them to tell you that this was more important because they'd listened to people, or it was people like you that had created this content. Well, that's what you could do on Facebook using community media. We've allowed the gatekeeper to control the access. And I think it's when you then show people that through using these tools, smartphones, digital platforms, AI, you know, treating it a way that it can help you to do that stuff, that what you realise is that someone who's interested in green issues, for example, across multiple platforms can make film content that you can look at, content that you can read, content that you can listen to, a podcast, using a smartphone, a few things like we're using here, you know, a Zoom recorder, a couple of microphones, can create much more effective content relevant to that subject matter, climate change, for example, that reaches globally, engages in an audience of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, can be treated seriously with the respect of the fact that you know the knowledge because you're interested in the subject and all that. Well, compare that to the person who's the green editor for The Guardian, who has 4, 5, 6 editions a week, and a website that they write on. And if you buy the newspaper, just because you're the columnist about the green issues in The Guardian, it doesn't mean that however many Guardians are bought every day that someone's going to read your column. You've actually got the power. Why are you defaulting it to the mainstream media? And I think sometimes people look at all conspiracy theories, or you're being very radical, or, you know, it's community driven, it's not serious. I think we need to understand that we need to flip the media ecosystem, because it's the wrong way round. We should leave the mainstream media to do the things that they're only interested in because they've been bought by business people and they've been in bed with the government. That actually, if people realise the real power they had through digital media platforms to make their content and started treating it just a little bit more seriously and with respect, then I think a lot of the issues that we see in the mainstream, but also across, you know, the global different places, wouldn't really exist, because we'd be able to hold them to account a lot more. So things like investigative journalism, you know, Bellingcat, these kind of things, you know, digital evidencing, looking at, you know, maps, looking at data sets and stuff like that. I think this is really going to be the future. But if we're only 15 years into it, it might take another 15 years before we get to it. So we're putting a lot of pressure on the internet, virtual space, digital media to solve these issues that for the last couple of hundred years have only been reported on by the mainstream media?
And
it's a very short period of time.
And you can look at this purely as an issue of data management and data extraction and data sort, and you can turn all of that into just an abstract kind of numerical process. But go back to and I want to explore with you what you learned in a, if you like, in an interpersonal, intercultural sense of being in Nigeria and then saying, go and talk to the street vendor who sells food. What was the challenge with that and for yourself? And then also the people that you were working with to say, no, this is an acceptable way of finding news and finding stories and looking for that people-centred. It's old-fashioned, you know, it's largely kind of driven out. You have stock and standard stereotypical phrases. And, you know, if you look at a lot of mainstream media, they will go out into the street and find a stereotypical person to stand in as a proxy for, you know, everybody else, and it's convenient, and they use PR agencies and all the rest of it to find talking heads, and it's a machine that just keeps regurgitating the same kind of stuff. Whereas when you step out of that, so what was the challenge of being in a part of Nigeria that not many Westerners visit, and seeing that and experience living that, what was that like?
Well, first of all, they're absolutely fascinated as to why you're there. You know what I mean? Why are you here? So, of course, your defense mechanism is that I'm going to explain to you why you're here. They're not actually asking you why you're there. They're saying, no, why are you here? Why do you even know about this place? You know, so I remember the International Film Festival last year in Kaduna. People said, well, why are you here? I said, well, I'm helping the film festival and I'm on a panel. And say, no, why are you in Kaduna? You know, how did you even know about this festival? Well, it's an international film festival. Is it? You know what I mean? So most of the time, you're actually getting people to look at where they are or what they're doing or their event from the point of view that it would be of interest to anybody else, because you don't treat it seriously yourself if you live there, you know. And again, we're very guilty of that here in Leicester with events that we have or certain buildings and stuff. To you, they're just this building. Someone else will come 1,000 miles to see it because of what its relevance is. So local culture is just as important. So you have to take those learnings from Citizen's Eye to somewhere like Nigeria. And I remember the very last event that I went to, they gave me another hat. Yeah, so I've got a couple of hats, and gave me one of these long gowns and a pair of sandals and stuff like that, and said, we'd like you to wear this at this event. So I'm automatically programmed, because of how we are in the UK, to say, well, cultural appropriation, you know, what will the impact on people be of me wearing local dress? And they're like, what are you talking about? And I was like, well, you know, back in the UK, I have to be really careful about what I wear and that kind of stuff, so I'm not seen as being, you know, trying to exploit someone or try to fit in where I don't know. Well, we don't understand that at all. You know, from our perspective, we told you in November that if you wear a hat, no matter where you go in Nigeria, there's different types of hat, but if you wear that hat, everyone will turn around and go, you're interested in our country. So if you wear this outfit, you know, you'll stand out because you're a white guy, quite clearly. But by wearing that, everyone will understand you're wearing the hat, you're wearing that. You want to be here, you're telling that story. And so it teaches you that sometimes the fear of upsetting someone stops you from doing something which would actually help people to understand why that thing's taking place. And that's really, for me, was one of the biggest learning things that I got from this trip, the third trip. You know, you think to the point, I've been here twice, and once 20 years ago, so it was my fourth trip to Nigeria, that, well, you know everything there, you're going to be all right, you know what I mean, you're comfortable with who you're with and all that sort of stuff. And then you get to this point where you learn something still, you still have your eyes open. So that's what drives me to do what I do, because I get as much out of it as what they say they get out of me being there. And I think that's one of the things about travel. You can watch it on YouTube and all that sort of stuff, and you can learn about the world and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, it should be, if you've got the ability and the money and the, you know, the interest, you should go, because as soon as you do, it changes your worldview, not of where you go, but of where you're from. You bring that home to your own thing. You know, it makes you much more. I often say I'm from the East End of London, so I grew up with, you know, lots of people from different places. All, so living in Leicester for me is East London, but with less people. I've still got that cultural mix of people. So talking to different people here is no different from how I was when I grew up. when I grew up. So when I go to Nigeria and I come back, my first interest is to find out, well, are there Nigerian people here that I could communicate with? Because, you know, really I should learn some more Hausa. I've got to stop being lazy, expecting people to speak English. And they, you know, they always fail miserably to teach me some words in Hausa. And then whenever I do, every single person laughs at me when I get it wrong. They're not laughing at me because I've got it wrong. They're just laughing because they've never heard anybody speak it that way. And you learn the fact that actually they're not laughing at you. They're laughing with you at the fact that at least you're having a go. And then you realise that, you know, they're not worried about cultural appropriation or you getting it wrong and stuff. They're more just delighted that you're there and having a go.
So has that taught you anything that you've brought back with you in terms of, you know, the UK? Positive or negative, you know, is like, what do we need to get over ourselves of, you know, or what do we need to
I think we've got to the point where, rightly or wrongly, that what we do is when someone talks to you about decolonizing something, or when someone talks to you about cultural appropriation, or when someone talks to you about reparations for the, you know, the colonial times or whatever, that by not engaging in those conversations in any kind of meaningful way, people are allowed to think that or have that opinion, rightly or wrongly, that we're always fearful then of upsetting someone. And because we're always fearful of upsetting someone, it stops us having a conversation at all about anything, because we think, oh, you know, this person will wonder why I'm asking, you know what I mean? Is it all right to ask why about that? So when you go somewhere like Nigeria, the only way you can find out is by asking someone. And then when you're asking that, it suddenly makes you think about, well, why was that a fear in my perspective in the first place? And so I remember, there's two stories I'll tell you. One was a couple of years ago, we were doing some Uganda 50 things here in the High Cross, and we had like all this stuff set up, what the monument was going to look like and stuff. And this guy came in, he said, oh, I'm a Ugandan Asian, my parents came, I was a kid then and stuff like that. And he had his three sons with him. And his three sons were taking part in all the activities with Tina Barton and stuff. And we got this chat conversation about it. And I said, well, obviously, you know, blah, 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 you know, colonial times coming over British. And he said, well, why are you saying that? So I said, well, you know, just acknowledging the fact that all that. He said, well, you don't need to do that. He said, you know, what the British did was they did what they did. You know, he said, we're just two blokes having a conversation. You know, Britain came and did that. That's fine. He said, I'll benefit from it because I'm there here with my family. And you guys need to get over yourself, you know what I mean? He said, yeah, reparations, whatever, you know what I mean? If we want to have that conversation, then fine. But, you know, almost like get over it yourself. I'm over it and I'm getting the benefits out of it. And I think with Britain today, we're still so fearful of who's coming and why they're here and what do they want and stuff like that we're missing the impact that people are having by being here. We're the ones with the problem, not those people.
It's interesting, the kind of mindset at the moment is our media is particularly renowned for stoking fear, but if you ask the question, what is it you're afraid of, and you genuinely mean, well, you know, your position on this is, what are you afraid of, or your rejection of this, or your embracing of something, is kind of ask that question. It's a really great question, because you kind of look at everybody and say, you know, what are you afraid of? And you can be talking about something which you positively embrace. Say, yeah, this is really good. This is a really, really great situation. These people are really nice. And you say, yeah, but what's the opposite of that? What is it you're afraid of? If somebody turns around and says, well, you know, we reject all of this, you say, well, what is it you're afraid of? And it really produces an interesting response, because everybody then has to kind of ask the question. You know, they have to look at themselves and go, well, actually, what is it? You know, there's something there which needs to be addressed, which we feel isn't being addressed or acknowledged in our media. And nobody's speaking on our behalf. So that fuels a cynicism and a spitefulness. Whereas if you've got that kind of sense of sincerity, that there's a kind of sense, no, it's okay, as you've just described, it's okay to have these conversations. It's okay to say, you know, there was a case a few years ago, was it in relation to Meghan Markle and a senior member of the royal family saying, where are you from? and it's, you know, and there was a big controversy about that being, you can't say that's a racist position automatically. And it's like, well, why is it that? Because it stokes the idea of fear that you haven't got established roots, is that you haven't got established place in society. So to ask that question exposes that, or it embeds somebody else's 1,000-year family history that puts them in the aristocracy, that kind of thing. And it illustrates and demonstrates that there's a big difference between people. So that fear element is used against people in the media to create phantoms and to almost to avoid the necessary conversations that we need. So there's a dismissiveness at the moment about protests about community cohesion, which are addressed as far right influenced, you know, manipulation and things. It's like, well, hang on a minute, let's just ask the question, what are those people who are involved in that? What are they afraid of? Is it legitimate they're afraid of that? Or is it, and the media, you know, our media doesn't go into that kind of depth and detail to understand that. And yet when you go somewhere else, often it's the first thing that people want to talk about. You know, it's like kind of, you know, it's always, as you say, it's ourselves who've got the problem, not other people.
Yeah, I mean, I go back to that Jack and Jill, you know, I often say to people when I'm doing these workshops, you know, go home, you know, pick a child in your family, you know, borrow a child from a family next door and say, well, I'll read you a bedtime story. Then go, Jack and Jill went up the hill. Good night. Turn the light off. Kid will go like, hang on, I'm only four, but I know that something happens, they get to the hill and then they fall down again. So why do we accept that in our media? Why do we accept clickbait headlines which are Jack and Jill went up the hill? So to use that analogy as well is, if a child worked in the night and was frightened of the thunder or a lightning storm, yeah? So what are you afraid of? I'm afraid of the lightning. You then go out to explain to them, you know, what it is, what causes it. The chances in a million of it actually hitting their house, let alone hurting them in their bed. You do all that sort of stuff. So how do we, when we say to someone, what are you afraid of? These people might be genuinely afraid of people coming over in boats. But until they can get the information, and if the only information they're being given is slightly skewed towards a far-right racist view of whatever it is, you can't really blame them for being there, because they see that as the only outlet they have for turning around and saying, well, actually, I'm just being afraid. I don't want to admit I'm afraid, but I'm fearful. And so until we can address that, that's always going to happen. You can't turn around and say, you're wrong for asking that question. You have to turn around and go, how can I get you the right information so that you're no longer fearful?
And the answer
fearful.
Is to go and talk to them and articulate
what
that
are you afraid
and find
of?
Out what it is.
What are you afraid of?
What are you looking forward to doing when you go back?
Well, when I go back in August, hopefully, it'll be the International Film Festival again in Kaduna, number 9. And this time I was very fortunate to be on the board of jurors, so I kind of selected some of the documentaries, so that'll be quite good to meet some of the filmmakers. But also, I'm trying to do things where I'm inviting other people to bring their portfolios along so we can review them, to get them on S24. We're looking to do a young person's training as well. I think that's a really important thing. Bring your smartphone along, you know, tell stories. Doesn't matter how you're telling the story, whatever way it is, the fact that you're telling stories. And what's interesting about working in a place like Nigeria, where, especially when you go to the north, in northern Nigeria, where there's a real kind of cultural and tradition that goes back thousands of years and predates colonial times, is that some of these things that are seen as sort of quaint traditional cultural practices from our perspective are probably actually effective democracy compared to maybe parliamentary systems that they have, or, you know, democracy systems they have in Nigeria and here, because actually it's much more inclusive, much more effective, much more you've got to give evidence as to why a judgment's happened. And it really challenges you to think that some of these stories that are told, how do we make them modern to engage young people? So, for example, here we've just had a social media ban for under 16s. I understand why. I understand why the government's done it. I understand why the parents of young people that have killed themselves because of that want it to be banned, because it's happened to them. There's no arguing about that. A bit like COVID, you know. In fact, it's impacted a lot of people in lots of ways. Some well, depending on what kind of ship you were on the size of your boat type. But then, are we holding social media companies account to how they set about these addictive ways of doing it. We've done the same with cigarette companies. We do the same with alcohol. Why aren't we doing the same with social media, particularly when it comes to young people under 16? But what we're not doing is we're not communicating with under 16s who up to this point have been able to use a smartphone and digital platforms to know more about the world than most adults already. They understand consequences, they understand what's going on. They're not included because they can't vote. Yeah, so they're not given any respect because they're still a kid. But they're being told that what you're doing is dangerous. You go, well, I like reading comics when I was younger, or I like playing on Space Invaders. So now I can play on Space Invaders and read graphic novels on social media platforms. You're banning it because I'm under 16. I've not done anything. I'm just under 16. Where are we taking those young people and their parents on that educational process to make the understanding that the reason it's been done is this? So for me, I was saying to someone this morning, the value of an arts award for a community organisation will go up because this young person can still be creative and engage in digital media and social media and stuff, but will use their arts award to make content that through this arts organisation can put that content out into the world for them to turn around to their parents and say, well, you can watch it on that community arts organisation's platform. I've just made that content. That's what I was doing on my smartphone some of the time when you came along and I was banned and you're making me banned. And I think what will happen is it will be banned by the government, and then what you'll start seeing is like collectives of parents getting together to create screen time for their young people in a controlled way for them to make content. One of the ways around it won't just be virtual private networks, VPN networks, it'll be networks of adults that come together and go, I don't see it as dangerous to my child when it's done in that way, what I always did.
Setting up their own community media platforms.
Yeah, absolutely.
Networks.
Touché. Community media, full yeah. circle. Very good.
Right, where can people find out more information about what you're doing?
Well, yeah, you can follow some of my social media channels, like, you know, Dot Media Centre and stuff. Someone stopped me in the street literally on the way here and just said, oh, that stuff you're doing in Northern Nigeria, it's mad, isn't it? Like, I'm looking at it thinking, that's like when you did Citizen's Eye there. I said, perfect. If you're thinking that, that's exactly what it is. And I think S24television.com, you know, having a look on there and just seeing what they're doing. Again, fighting that battle between being seen as a mainstream media organisation but trying to change the media ecosystem, which is getting more people to tell genuine stories. So a real challenge, yeah.
You've been listening to Decentered Media with me, Rob Watson. Find out more at decentered.co.uk or follow on social media at Decentered Media.